Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei says a major accomplishment of Qasem Soleimani was to reinvigorate the resistance front. A new report says Israeli forces arrested nearly 7,000 Palestinians, including hundreds of women and children. And Moscow says it has destroyed Ukraine's drone facilities, launch sites, and Kiev denies. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has described the revival of the resistance front as a major achievement of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei was speaking ahead of the anniversary of General Soleimani's assassination by the U.S. Iran's leader said the late general protected, equipped, and prepared the resistance against the Israeli regime and against the influence of the U.S. and other American countries. He cited the defeat of Daesh terrorists as another major achievement of General Qasem Soleimani. Ayatollah Khamenei said General Soleimani propped up the resistance in Iraq and Syria using their domestic potential. Analyst Hakime Sakaibiria argues that the Trump administration made a big mistake by assassinating General Soleimani, and that is because his mentality remains in place and resistance has turned out to be even more powerful than before.
This is another example of the short-sightedness of the United States. You know, from all the different political, leanings that there are in the United States, you know, from the Democrats and to the Republicans. You know, this happened during the time of the Trump presidency, but you see this sort of short-sightedness on the part of the Democrats as well. But this was, the thing that they were thinking, I think, was that by the physical removal of this personality from the scene, they would put an end to the resistance, to the ongoing resistance that was, you know, becoming more powerful as they went by. But, experience showed that not only didn't resistance stop, but it became more powerful, it became more steadfast. And of course, over the years, Ayatollah Khamenei has mentioned that when you look at the personality of Sardar Soleimani, Shahid Soleimani, you shouldn't look at him as a person, but as a school of thought.
Afghan people have gathered at Iran's cultural center in Kabul to pay tribute to the veteran anti-terror commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Namatullah Bakwan reports.
Afghan people from different walks of life have gathered here at Iran's cultural center to mark the third assassination anniversary of anti-terror commander General Qasem Soleimani. Participants expressed sympathy with the Iranian nation, saying that General Soleimani was a hero for the entire region.
The pain and grief of the loss of the great martyr Soleimani does not only belong to Iranians. Sardar Soleimani is the hero and flag bearer of the fight against terrorism in the region. He played a very significant and decisive role in our world.
It's the duty of the Muslim world to call for justice for General Soleimani. This huge crime, the killing of a Muslim Iranian general by the U.S., should be investigated by the U.N. Commander Soleimani was targeted by the U.S. when he was busy fighting international terrorism and U.N.-designated terrorist groups.
Participants also say that Commander Soleimani played a key role in the defeat of the Daesh terrorist group in West Asia and in the fight against international criminals.
Commander Soleimani, as a commander of Islam, was there for Muslims everywhere. He was active and supported oppressed people in Yemen, Syria, Iraq, and Bosnia-Herzegovina. Likewise, he was involved in a fight against the arrogance in Afghanistan, too. He trained and directed Afghans to defend their soil against invaders and maintain their freedom. Commander Soleimani fought in a campaign for the freedom of Muslim Ummah.
Along with other admirers of General Soleimani, Afghans every year commemorate the legacy and life of the anti-terrorism hero. Afghan people have long been fighting for their freedom. They remember General Soleimani as a leader and a role model for them and for all freedom seekers. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Moving on, the Iranian army has staged large-scale naval exercises in the Sea of Oman and north of the Indian Ocean. The drills are aimed at testing domestically built military equipment and enhancing the country's preparedness against potential threats. Yusuf Jalali reports.
The Iranian army's radars have spotted a hostile UAV flying 25,000 feet above its southern waters. Its mission was to strike sensitive Iranian military facilities. The army quickly operated its homegrown Talosh missile system, and this is what happened to the intruding drone. This scenario was part of the last phase of a large-scale military drill held over an area stretching from the Strait of Hormuz all the way to the Sea of Oman and north of the Indian Ocean.
The drills cover a 3 million square kilometer area. They aim to test the preparedness of our young personnel and our military equipment that have recently been added to our fleet. Our military might send the message of peace and friendship to our neighbors, but to our enemies, it's a show of power and deterrence.
The three-day maneuver saw the deployment of several pieces of domestically built equipment, from drones and missile systems to warships, submarines, and tanks. The country has been building up its defense arsenal against the backdrop of the West's arms embargoes on Tehran. The army says today it is capable of protecting the country's land, air, and sea borders using locally developed hardware.
All of the systems used in these maneuvers have been developed domestically. They are designed to hit targets at different altitudes. These exercises show that we, as the Air Defense Force, along with other branches of the army, are fully capable of defending our country using military technologies that have been fully developed domestically.
The Army's Air Defense Force also used its Mersad missile systems to strike hostile air targets. The Army says it's working on more advanced missile systems to further bolster its deterrent power.
The naval drill engages all of the four branches of the Iranian Army, including its Air Defense Force, which has deployed its latest homegrown missile systems. The Army says this is to boost synergy between its different units to be ready to confront any potential threats to its territorial waters. Yusuf Jalali from the location of the drill.
A new report by the Palestine Center for Prisoner Studies shows Israeli forces have detained 7,000 Palestinians in 2022. Nearly 900 prisoners were children, 150 of them under the age of 12. The director of the center says the Israeli forces detain Palestinians on a daily basis and help them under horrific circumstances. A number of detainees have been released while many others remain in prison. Some 400 Palestinians have been arrested under the pretext of incitement against Israel on social media. Saudi Arabia's attempt to cover up its rights abuses is once again getting international attention, especially after Portugal star Cristiano Ronaldo joined a Saudi football club. During our news review program, we discuss the issue with our guests. Let's take a listen.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Saudi Arabia has repeatedly and widely faced accusations of using sports to cover up human rights abuses, a practice that is called sports washing. Those claims were given a fresh boost with the lucrative move of Portugal star Cristiano Ronaldo to a Saudi club. Ronaldo has signed for 2.5 seasons as player for Al Nassr. Media reports say the 37-year-old could be earning up to $200 million a year from the deal, making him the highest-paid sportsman in the world. He will also reportedly serve as an ambassador for Saudi Arabia's ambitious project to host the 2030 World Cup. There was also an international outcry when Saudi Arabia's sovereign wealth fund took over the Premier League team Newcastle. Saudi Arabia has also been using other sports such as Formula One, boxing, and golf to promote its image worldwide. The kingdom faces international criticism for its human rights violations, both domestically and abroad, including the war in Yemen and the brutal murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi in the year 2018. All right, let's bring in Santos Al-Assad, who's a journalist and human rights advocate, joining us from Beirut. Also, Tony Gosling, who's an investigative journalist, joins us from London. All right, I'd like to welcome you both. And let me go to our guest first in Beirut and ask you, what do you think about the connection that is being made between sports washing and Saudi Arabia? And it seems like Saudi Arabia is the one that tops the list because it goes out and spends a lot of money. Why do you think it does that? Do you agree with the premise that it does that in order to kind of cover up, perhaps, this human rights situation inside the kingdom?
Well, you know that the term sport washing has been coined to show how those repressive regimes manipulate sport in order to conceal the atrocities and the human rights violations that are committed by them. And you know that the Saudi regime is one of those repressive regimes, which is widely known for its human rights infringement, is the wide arrests of human rights activists and prisoners of conscience. So they use manipulate those influencers in order to show themselves as to whitewash their crimes, and they on purpose choose those personalities in order to not be held accountable for the crimes that they commit. Especially crimes against basic human rights, as the right of expressing opinion or many rights that are being committed in Saudi Arabia. So those who take part in these issues. They become representative of such regimes. So Ronaldo is being part of this, will be complicit in such crimes of covering those human rights abuses.
Looking back at March of 2021, Tony Gosling, the headline read that Saudi Arabia has spent $1.5 billion in sports washing. And it included the different types of sports, such as soccer, such as boxing, etc. Saudi Arabia is making anywhere from $750 million to $1 billion per day now with these oil prices. I'm guessing Cristiano Ronaldo is probably one of the splurges that it is making on this. But tell us the association between how you bring in these foreign players to represent Saudi Arabia and how that contributes to Saudi Arabia's image getting a makeover.
Well, I'm not sure he's... Can you make it clear? Is he actually representing Saudi Arabia's national team?
Well, the team that we know that he was signed up to was Al Nasr or Al Masr. I'm not sure. Yeah. I actually forget the
name of
the team.
No, I think what's going on here is that the Saudis are bringing him in to one of their regional teams or city teams in order to... it is public relations, isn't it? The idea is that you have some of the world's greatest footballers. You pay them or bribe them to come to your country and work there in order to give good public relations commentary around the world. So all the sports fans love your country. They think your country's great because their favourite footballer is over there. And the idea is this nudges aside all of the awful things that your country is doing. And I mean, we're not free of being guilty of this in England too, and in the UK either, because a lot of countries now look to sport as a way to sanitise their human rights abuses. You're quite right. And because they know that the human rights abuses are not being covered in, for example, in the Western media, but the sport will be. So that's how they're trying to do that. But I mean, here in England, we are known around the world as one of the places which was the origin of modern football in the Victorian era. And back then, you had everybody in the local football team would be from that town, from that city. We've seen since the middle of the last century, players being bought by other, and so money coming into the sport. So if a player gets particularly good, then maybe another city will buy them. And now, of course, there is the temptation of this to happen internationally. And money is completely, I mean, many fans here in Britain just simply don't go to games anymore because they know that money is destroying the sport and the local connection. That's part of the fun, is going to support your local city. And that isn't the case anymore because almost all of our large teams, the Premier League here and the first, second division, whatever, the large division teams are largely made up of either foreign players that have been bought into the UK or else, you know, people who've been players who've been bought from other cities. And so money has been destroying this game. And I also think that we've seen in the Western media generally, well, there's a lot of money goes on culture, but very little is going to our museums, our research in our universities. That's all being closed and privatised. And in investigative documentaries into social issues, that sort of thing is being shut down. And it's being replaced by an enormous budget, even a government budget, going into sport. So the idea is that forget, you know, your cultural heritage and your history. The money's great, the sport is great. And the origins of this are really in this whole idea that that sport is about prowess, physical prowess, uh-huh, and physical ability, not mental prowess and mental ability. So it's all about dumbing down.
Thank you very much for that. Santos Al-Assad, their journalist and human rights advocate from Beirut. Thank you for your input. Also, Tony Gosling, thank you, investigative journalist there from London. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
School of Soleimani. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. We are on the anniversary of martyrdom of the great anti-terror general and commander of hearts, Qasem Soleimani. As for the third part of this five-part series, you will be listening to Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani's role in the war against the U.S.-generated terrorists known as Daesh or ISIS. Stay tuned, please. Quds Force is one of the branches of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, IRGC, whose duty goes beyond the geographical borders of the Islamic Republic of Iran. In other words, wherever the Islamic revolution is threatened by the global arrogance and Zionist regime and their lackeys, the IRGC quotes force will enter the scene to fight invaders and ill-wishers. Quds Force has been founded on the basis of Imam Khomeini's thought, as he said, "Today the East and the West know it well that Islam is the only force which can expel them from the scene. The officials should know that. A revolution is not limited to Iran. The Iranian people's revolution is the starting point of the great revolution of the Islamic world under the flag of Imam Mahdi. May God have favor on all Muslims and the world people to ordain his reappearance and coming in the present age." According to Imam Khomeini, defending Islam and fighting the big powers requires mobilization of the forces of Islam all over the world. The idea of formation of Defenders of Shrine was based on this very thought of Imam Khomeini. Martyr Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani set up the Defenders of Shrine to confront and annihilate the criminal Daesh outfit. His planning and method against these beasts of the current era was based on his precious experiences of the eight-year war against the U.S.-sponsored Iraqi regime of Saddam in 1980s. He considered those experiences as an appropriate pattern to defend oppressed nations against oppressors and greedy powers. He would say, "When a nation is under oppression and an unequal assault has been made against it, if it wants to defend its dignity and nobility in a victorious way, the method of victory that was experienced is the method of the holy defense." The fruit of Martyr Soleimani's management and prudence was the formation of the Resistance Front. This front has been shaped up of different combat groups like the Hezbollah of Lebanon, Hashd al-Sha'bi of Iraq, Fatemiyun of Afghanistan, Zainabiyun of Pakistan, Haydariyun of Iraq, Ansarullah of Yemen, and so on. Various forces from Iran, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Afghanistan, and Pakistan were mobilized to defend the Holy Shrine of Lady Zainab in Syria and the Holy Shrines of the Infallible Imams in Iraq against Daesh terrorists. Daesh terrorist grouplet was shaped by the U.S. with the help of the fabricated Israeli regime and some of the Arab reactionary regimes, particularly the Saudi regime, to fight Islam under the guise of Islam. These generators and exporters of terrorism were plunged in the dream of the imminent fall of Syria and capturing of Syria and Iraq by their trained dog. But General Soleimani believed that the big U.S.-Israeli-Saudi plot for disintegration of the region would fail with the help of God. Thus, 4 years later, the political and media centers in the West and the Arab world admitted the defeat of their mercenary elements in the region against the Resistance Front. The courage and valor of the Commander of Hearts, General Qasem Soleimani, was famous all over the world. In the heat of the battle against Daesh, this sentence could be read on the website attributed to Martyr Soleimani: "Mr. Abu Bakr Baghdadi, the day when you were saying in the Friday prayer that we will take Qasem Soleimani too and will put him in the cage and burn him like the Jordanian pilot, I was sitting in the third row just in front of you."
Thank you.
In a short time, Daesh terrorist outfit spread its unholy dominance over 70% of Syria and reached near the Iraqi capital of Baghdad. Yet, the unmatched general Qasem Soleimani expanded the domain of defense with the help of resistance forces. Now the nightmare of terrorists rushed to assist the Iraqi besieged Iraqi people. He said on the reason of his presence in Iraq, "When we entered for defending of the Iraqi people, we never separated the Iranian interest from the Iraqi ones. We considered the interest of the Iraqi people as our own interest, saying that if they are victorious, freed and achieve sovereignty, these are the same as our interest. This is the outward and inward of our assistance to Iraq and Syria, and we were never in pursuit of shares and interests." According to the commander of Al-Badr Corps of Iraq, Hadi al-Amiri, Daesh was horrified even by the name of General Soleimani. He said in an interview during the life of this great martyr, "If you browse the Daesh media, you will understand how much the Takfiris are scared of this heroic combatant." Masoud Barzani, former head of the Iraqi Kurdistan, writes in his memoirs on the days when Daesh terrorists had approached Erbil and how he had contacted the embassies of the US, Turkey, Britain, France, and even Saudi regime, but none of them had agreed to help him. He writes, "The only person who came to our help was Haj Qasem Soleimani. He came with 50% of his special forces. He quickly went to the region of clashes. He mobilized Peshmerga forces and everything changed within a few hours. Later on, we captured the Daesh commander and asked him about the reason for retreating from Erbil. He answered, 'Our spies informed us that Qasem Soleimani is in Erbil. So the forces were demoralized and we retreated.'" Qasem Soleimani never forgot the oppressed people of Palestine. He caused the Palestinian resistance to enter a new phase of combat. He empowered Gaza as he considered no difference between them and other forces of the resistance front. He would help everyone to fight the fake Zionist regime. The name of Quds played a pivotal role in his life. During the 8-year Holy Defense, Tariq al-Quds, or the Way to Quds operation, was the first operation in which he commanded two battalions. After the 8-year war, he was appointed as the commander of the IRGC Quds base in the east of Iran to confront miscreants and smugglers. And in the year 1999, he was appointed as the commander of the Quds force. And his blood will be avenged by the liberation of Quds, inshallah.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and since people in the West are celebrating the new year, we hereby present a thought-provoking statement from Prophet Jesus, peace be upon him, as recorded in the Gospel of St. Barnabas, about the coming of the last prophet of God. O Jesus, say to the unjust Israelites, You have cleaned your faces but sullied your hearts. Are you deceived against me, or are you challenging me? You are odorizing yourselves for people of this world, while your interiors are same as stinking carrions, as if you are dead people.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is the show A to Z. For today's program, Brother Muhammad is going to talk to us about Islamic education. Stay tuned.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's discussion with regards to Islamic education, we would like to look at an important aspect of the Islamic value system, which is the performance of salah, or the daily prayers. Now, this salah is not restricted to the daily prayers alone, but when it comes to the obligation of salah, it begins with the daily prayers. When we look at inculcating this and nurturing this aspect of the Islamic lifestyle into our children, we find salah to be a very important act of worship on one hand. But on the other side, we find that salah is something that cannot be forced, cannot be inculcated in one go. Rather, it needs to be nurtured over a span of time with patience, with perseverance, and with the right mixture of what to teach, what to inculcate, and at what time. And indeed, we find that at around the age of 6 years, the children need to be introduced to salah such that they start praying. Now, obviously, for boys and girls, there might be different expectations, because girls become baligh and reach the age of maturity at 9, and boys become baligh around the age of 15. But in any case, the instructions from the Holy Ahlul Bayt alayhim wassalam is that the children need to be commended and enjoined towards salah around the age of 6. Now, there are certain principles that we as parents need to keep in mind when we go about teaching salah to our kids. And one of the very important principles of inculcating and nurturing salah is that the parents take it slow and gradual, and they do not pressure the children. Rather, they go forward in inculcating Salah with ease for the children. So number one, let's keep our expectations low at first. Let's introduce the very basic elements of Salah and thereafter build on them slowly and gradually. We find that in the human being, there are many capacities, but these capacities and potentials get nurtured and they flower over a span of time. And a child cannot be expected to reach perfect state of Salah overnight or even in a week. The child needs to first be able to observe prayer being performed and thereafter try and emulate it in whatever way he or she can. And thereafter, once they reach that age, that at 6 years of age or so, between 5 and 7, on one hand, their internal God conscious, their godly innate conscience, the fitra, is blooming and they're feeling the urge to thank Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on one hand. Their godly inclination is pushing them towards Salah on one hand, and on the other hand, they are being taken by the hand and taught Salah. Now, this is a very important stage that if the child is pressured too much, the child may not be able to continue. But on the other hand, if the child is limited based on very few expectations, then again, the progress and the development, the spiritual progress and development of the child would be stinted. Therefore, the parents need to be very careful in balancing the nature of the child and the capacities that the child possesses with the slow and gradual process of inculcation and nurturing Salah. I hope you enjoyed today's discussion. Until next time, fi amanillah, under God's protection.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.ir.
At approximately 2:27 this morning, San Francisco police officers were dispatched to the residence of Speaker Nancy Pelosi regarding an A-priority well-being check. When the officers arrived on scene, they encountered an adult male and Mr. Pelosi's husband, Paul. Our officers observed Mr. Pelosi and the suspect both holding a hammer. The suspect pulled the hammer away from Mr. Pelosi and violently assaulted him with it. Our officers immediately tackled the suspect, disarmed him, took him into custody, requested emergency backup, and rendered medical aid. The suspect has been identified as 42-year-old David DePepe.
The assault came less than 2 weeks before midterm elections, in which control of the House and the Senate is at stake, raising fears about political violence.
The news reports indicate it was intended to be an attack on the House Nancy Pelosi lives in, the third ranking person in the United States in line to be president. You know, It's reported that the same chant was used by this guy they have in custody that was used on January 6th in the attack on the U.S. Capitol. I'm not making this up. This is reported. I can't guarantee it. I can tell you what's being reported. The chant was, "Where's Nancy? Where's Nancy? Where's Nancy?" This is despicable. There's no place in America. There's too much violence, political violence, too much hatred.
Donald Trump, who's still the de facto leader of the Republican Party, didn't fully condemn the attack on Paul Pelosi. In an interview on Spanish-language Americano media, he called the attack a terrible thing and then quickly connected it to Republican criticisms of the rising crime in U.S. cities. At the same time, Trump himself is being blamed for fostering a dangerous political climate, not least for insisting on stolen votes in the last presidential election in the country.
I ran twice. I won twice. I did much better the second time than I did the first, getting millions and millions of more votes in 2020 than we did in 2016, and likewise getting more votes than any sitting president in the history of our country, as I said. And now we might just have to do it again. I think you're going to be very happy. I think you'll be very happy.
Americans are now sharply divided along partisan lines over their trust in the federal election system, according to a new Politico Morning Consult poll coming days ahead of midterm elections.
Our biggest threat remains the sick, sinister, and evil people from within our country. But no matter how big or powerful the corrupt radical left Democrats that we are fighting against may be, you must never forget this nation does not belong to them. This nation belongs to you. This nation belongs to you.
The gulf between the two after the attack highlighted the country's internal political estrangement ahead of the midterm elections.
And I want to take a moment just to say a prayer for a friend of mine, Mr. Paul Pelosi, who was attacked. A politics where some in office or who aspired to office worked to stir up division, to make folks as angry and as afraid of one another for their own advantage.
Republicans remained unwilling to upset their voters by being more critical of the extremism running through the GOP base. That's while Democrats were trying to link rising threats against lawmakers and their families with Trump's political movement as spiraling inflation threatens to deal them a heavy defeat at the ballot box.
Inflation is through the roof. You gotta decide between medication and food.
It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. Everything going up, but shit, you can't spend. You go to the store with $10, $20, you ain't come out with one bag. You know, you really can't win.
The Pelosi attack has kindled already fraught debate over the repercussions of political speech, particularly in the wake of last year's attack on the U.S. Capitol.
I did talk with Speaker Pelosi this morning, and I mean, this was an act of extreme violence, and I think we're looking at a time in our country where there is so much discourse that is fueled by hate and division. And anyone who professes to be a leader, I think, has to really understand the meaning and the impact of their words and their posture on things like this. I pray for Paul's recovery. I know the Pelosi's, and this is tragic. Somebody literally broke into their home saying, "Where's Nancy?" And I strongly believe that we all, each one of us, have to speak out against hate. We have to speak out against violence, obviously, and speak to our better selves. There is absolutely room, and it is important to have public discourse when there are disagreements about policy, but what we've been seeing recently is so base in terms of reducing it down to something that I think is beneath the dignity and the intelligence of the American people.
While Democratic leaders were quick to condemn the attack, Republican leaders increasingly minimized its severity or turned a blind eye. In some cases, they even made jokes about the assault. For example, Donald Trump Jr. shared an image on social media of a hammer and a pair of underwear with the words, "Got my Paul Pelosi Halloween costume ready." Election denialism, the growth of QAnon and Donald Trump, cult people that love our country, have already divided the American nations. Furthermore, a belief that un-American cadres have captured the government, cultural institutions and businesses acts to spur Trump's followers and a sizable minority of votes to conclude that dire steps are required.
Sadly, there is a huge influence from between, I would say, the far-right communities and extremist communities such as QAnon to the mainstream politics. We'll just take the example, for instance, what happened after the Mar-a-Lago raid, where Trump was pretty much calling the FBI as the people that is coming after him, that it is just part of a much larger conspiracy theory. And then immediately you saw plots to attack the FBI, and one of them actually was already at the FBI headquarters in Ohio trying to carry out an attack.
The language that Republican officials use show contempt for state authority, including law enforcement, a pervasive distrust of the objective news media, a perception that America is in grave peril, and a growing acceptance of conspiracy theories and white supremacist sentiments.
We know this. January 6th last year wasn't an insurrection. No one has been charged with insurrection. No one has been charged with treason. But it very well may have been a Fed surrection. We are very concerned that we have sent letter after letter to Attorney General Garland and FBI Director Wray to simply get to the bottom of unexplained circumstances.
My question is this: why is this Congress obsessed with itself and cares nothing about the American people? This is a two-tiered justice system that should never exist in our country, and I'm fed up with it, and so are Americans all over the country.
To add fuel to the fire, Democrats' economic policies have not resulted in tangible benefits, such as helping with medical bills, building new bridges, or trying to keep jobs from going offshore.
This will be, what they're doing right now, the biggest tax hike in the history of our country, the exact opposite of what I did, and they're working feverishly to pile on more regulations at levels never seen before.
A YouGov poll carried out a few months ago indicated over 40% of Americans think civil war is at least somewhat likely within the next decade. And with political violence now rising to the surface, things aren't looking gloomy for the Americans. America's politics is so toxic that it quickly turned the Pelosi attack into the latest vicious partisan fight, even before the full facts are known. Is the U.S. a tinderbox? We'll just have to wait and see. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
In the U.S., 6 years of Donald Trump's tax returns were made public by a congressional committee on Friday, 30th of December, ending the former president's long-running effort to break precedent and keep them secret. We'll take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. ABC News has covered the story and tells us more. The democratically controlled House Ways and Means Committee on Friday, 30th of December, publicly released documents relating to former President Donald Trump's tax returns, covering the 6 years from 2015 to 2020. The move comes after committee members voted 24-16 last week to release the documents after sensitive information such as bank account numbers and social security numbers had been redacted. Donald Trump has long fought to keep his tax records private, breaking precedent with previous presidents who made such documents public. Donald Trump released a statement on Friday, pushing back on the House committee for making the records public, while also claiming they show how proudly successful he has been. The Democrats should have never done it, the Supreme Court should have never approved it, and it's going to lead to horrible things for so many people, Trump said. He added, the great USA divide will now grow far worse. The radical left Democrats have weaponized everything, but remember that is a dangerous two-way street. The thousands of pages of tax records released on Friday revealed some new information, as well as confirmed past reporting about Donald Trump's personal and business finances. The records confirm previous reporting that Trump held a number of foreign bank accounts, including while in office, and appeared to have lied about at least one of them. According to Trump's tax returns, Trump reported having a bank account in China in 2015, 2016, and 2017, despite having claimed in 2020 that the account was closed before he ran for president. I closed it before I even ran for president, let alone became president, Trump said during one debate against Joe Biden in October of 2020. According to the tax returns, Trump also reported having income from or paying taxes to over a dozen foreign countries, including the United Kingdom, Georgia, Qatar, China, Mexico, and the United Arab Emirates. Donald Trump and his wife Melania also reported charitable donations that slowly decreased over the years. During his first year as president, the two reported making $1.9 million in charitable gifts. In 2018 and 2019, they donated roughly $500,000 each year, and in 2020, they reported no charitable giving. Committee Chairman Richard Neal, a Democrat from Massachusetts, told reporters last Tuesday that the committee found there was no ongoing audit of Trump's tax returns during his presidency until the committee requested them, despite an IRS requirement that tax returns filed by a sitting president or vice president are subject to audit. Richard Neal said the audit only began in 2019 after he requested the returns and said the audits of the requested returns were never completed. The tax forms were really never audited, and only my sending a letter at one point prompted a rear-view mirror response, Richard Neal said. The committee had requested 6 years' worth of Donald Trump's tax returns from the Treasury Department as part of what it said was an investigation into IRS audit practices of presidents and vice presidents. Trump has accused the committee of seeking his taxes under false pretenses, saying the probe is just a politically motivated fishing expedition. But the committee said the documents were critical for drafting legislation on equitable tax administration, including legislation on the president's tax compliance. According to a summary released last week by the committee, Donald Trump and his wife Melania together reported $31.7 million in losses and reported just under $642,000 in net taxes during the first year of Trump's presidential campaign, That is 2015. British News of The Guardian has also covered the story. 6 years of Donald Trump's tax returns were made public by a congressional committee on Friday, 30th of December, ending the former president's long-running effort to break precedent and keep them secret. The documents, dating from 2015 to 2020, offer insight into the complex finances and foreign bank accounts of a man who was accused of abusing the presidency for personal profit, and who has already announced another bid for the White House. A House of Representatives report released early this month analyzed the documents and showed Donald Trump and his wife Melania paid no federal income tax in 2020, the last full year he was in office. The couple paid just under $642,000 in federal income taxes in 2015, the year Trump began his campaign for president. They paid $750 in 2016 and 2017, nearly $1 million in 2018, $133,000 in 2019, and nothing in 2020, the year Trump unsuccessfully sought re-election. Such numbers reflect heavy business losses and undermine Donald Trump's self-perpetuated narrative of commercial wealth and success, a crucial part of his brand during his successful 2016 presidential campaign. Trump reported bank accounts in Britain, China, and Ireland from 2015 to 2017, and from 2018 only reported a bank account in Britain. During a presidential debate in 2020, Trump said the Chinese account was closed back in 2015. He insisted, "I closed it before I even ran for president, let alone became president." Responding to the release on Friday, Daniel Goldman, a congressman-elect from New York who was counsel to House Democrats in Donald Trump's first impeachment trial, said, "Generally, you only have bank accounts in a foreign country if you are doing transactions in that country's currency. What business was Donald Trump doing in China while he was president of the United States?" The tax returns also show Trump claimed foreign tax credits for taxes paid on business ventures around the world, including licensing arrangements for the use of his name on development projects and his golf courses in Scotland and Ireland. During his first 3 years in office, Donald Trump apparently fulfilled his campaign promise to give his salary to charity. But in 2020, he reported zero in charitable giving. Last week, the committee decided in a party-line vote to make their tax returns public. Democrats argued that transparency and the rule of law were at stake. Republicans said the release would set a dangerous precedent with regard to privacy protections. Don Beyer, a Virginia Democrat, praised over a pro forma House session on Friday as the tax returns were released just days before Democrats cede control to Republicans. Don Beyer said, despite promising to release his tax returns, Donald Trump refused to do so and abused the power of his office to block basic transparency of his finances and conflicts of interest, which no president since Richard Nixon has forgone. Donald Trump acted as though he had something to hide, a pattern consistent with the recent conviction of his family business for criminal tax fraud. As the public will now be able to see, Donald Trump used questionable or poorly substantiated deductions and a number of other tax avoidance schemes as justification to pay little or no federal income tax in several of the years examined.